Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're going to be in Genesis 28 today. It just follows exactly what's happening in 27. Rebekah has heard that Esau is so mad that when Isaac died, he's going to kill Jacob. And she is going to try to find a way for Isaac to send Jacob away. So she brings up the fact of how these daughters of the Canaanites are driving her bonkers. And so she mentions that to her husband. Now, her husband knows, based on the words of Abraham back in Genesis 24, verses 3 and 4, that they needed to marry inside the faith. This has nothing to do with interracial marriage. This has to do with interfaith marriage. And so as Abraham sent his servant back to find Rebekah, Isaac needs to do the same thing with Jacob. And what has exacerbated this problem is Esau has married two Canaanite women. Now, I don't know what they did that drove Rebekah crazy, but they must have done something because it's mentioned two times. In 26:35 and in 27:46, maybe they cooked food different or idolaters, I just don't know. So Rebekah brings this up to Isaac. And Isaac, I think by this time he's realized that Esau is not the one the promised line is going to go through, obviously. That he had somewhat violated God's will because God had told Rebekah earlier it would be Jacob, the younger. And Isaac had seemed to try to go a different way. So in the beginning of chapter 8, So Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said to him, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan." Now it seems the fact that Isaac blessed him shows that he recognizes that though Jacob acted inappropriately in the way he got the blessing, that it was still God's will, that he's the one that the promised covenant will go through. "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. Arise and go to Paddan Aram, the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and from there take to yourself a wife from the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother." Now, where is Paddan Aram? Well, we think this means the plains of Aram. Now, later on in history, people known as Arminians or Syrians are going to start a kingdom just north of the Promised Land, with the capital at Damascus. But at this period, this seems to refer to the settlers around Haran. You know, God called Abraham from Ur of the Chaldees. He moved to Haran. And from there, Abraham went to the Promised Land. So I think somewhere between the Tigris and Euphrates, it's in their headwaters. Notice it says then, "And may God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you, that you become a company of people." There's two very important words here. The English translation, "God Almighty," is the Hebrew word El Shaddai. I have always thought that means God Almighty. One of my professors up at Trinity Evangelical told me he thought it meant many-breasted. But I never have been able to search out that etymology, so I think until I'm able to find that and see if I agree with it or not, I think El is certainly strong. This name seems to be what the patriarchs called God. It's found in Genesis 17:1, 18:3, 35:11, 43:14, 48:3, and a form that I think really probably is El Shaddai is found in 49:25. Now, what complicates this is Exodus 6, verse 2. And I want to read that because I think it's that kind of verse. "And God spoke further to Moses and said, 'I am Yahweh. And I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as El Shaddai. But my name is Yahweh. I did not make myself known to them.'" And yet, throughout the text of Genesis, the name Yahweh appears. They may have known that God was called Yahweh, but I don't think they understood the implications of it. And I think their general name, their common name to describe the God who led them and helped them and loved them, protected them, was El Shaddai. Notice it mentions the word, and become a company of peoples. Notice the plural. This goes back, obviously, to the promise to Abraham in 12, 15, 17, and 22, that you'll be a large family, and that many kingdoms will come out of you. But the Hebrew word here is unique. It's the Hebrew word kahal. And the translators of the Septuagint are going to translate this word company, usually in English assembly, by the Greek term ekklesia. And that, of course, is going to be the title that the early church chooses for themselves, the ekklesia of God. I think it was the New Testament believer's way of saying we're the same group of people that have always followed this God. And that seems to be the understanding. May He also give you the blessing of Abraham to you and your descendants with you, that you may possess the land of your sojourning which God gave to Abraham. Now, Isaac has come a long way. Apparently, his favorite was Esau. He tried to bless Esau. He thought he was blessing Esau, but he wasn't. And now, I think he's come to the full, apparently theological understanding of that, and he confers on Jacob, knowingly, the Abrahamic blessing. I think that's significant here. Then Isaac sent Jacob away, and he went to Paddan Aram to Laban, son of Bethuel, the Syrian, the brother of Becca, the mother of Jacob and Esau. Now Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Paddan Aram to take to himself a wife from there, and that he blessed him as he charged him, saying, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan." Same thing Abraham said to his servant in Genesis 24, 3 and 4. So Esau saw the daughters of Canaan displease his father Isaac, as well as his mother. Just look at 26:35 and 27:46. And Esau went to Ishmael. Ishmael's been dead now a few years. And married, besides the wives he had, and notice her name here is Mahalatha, and the daughter of Ishmael. But in Genesis 36:3, she's called Basemath. B-A-S-E-M-A-T-H. Now, why the two names, I'm not sure. But here again, we're seeing a little insight into the character of Esau. He wanted the blessing, and he missed it. He wants some kind of blessing. He saw that Jacob was blessed again by his father in connection with his marriage. He heard his father say, "Don't take a wife from these Canaanite women." So he said, "Well, I'll go take a wife from the sons of Ishmael." So here's another good example of Esau trying to do the right thing and do it in the wrong way. He went and got another wife to try to get his father to bless him. But again, his nature as a secular, rather spiritually lackadaisical man is shown. Then Jacob departed from Beersheba. That's, of course, the well of the oath, or the well of the seven. Could be either one. And went to Haran. Apparently, it was a leisurely journey, and he didn't rush or take a horse. He apparently was walking. And he came to a certain place. Now, in Hebrew, it's rather definite, the certain place. And there have been many discussions by the rabbi about where this place is. It seems to be a several-day journey from Beersheba. The site we think this is, Bethel, in the foothills of Ephraim, is about 3 days' journey. It's about 70 hours or so. So he was going kind of leisurely, right? And he did not know this was a famous place or a special place, but it just happened that night fell and caught him in this special place, though he didn't know it. Now, this general area does have a connection with Abraham. Back in Genesis 12:8, And back in 13, 3 and 4, in this general area, Abraham had met God. And he spent the night there because the sun had set. Took him by surprise, apparently. And he took one of the stones of the place and put it up under his head, and he lay down in that place. Went to sleep. Shepherds are used to sleeping with rocks as kind of a place they put their head. And he had a dream, and behold, a ladder was set up on the earth, with its top reaching to heaven, and behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. Several things. Some say, the rabbis say, that this site is Mount Moriah. Where? The place where the temple later stood, the place where Abraham offered Isaac. But I don't think that's true. It seems to be Bethel, which is a site north of Jerusalem. Also, this ladder, when I think of a ladder, I think of a painter's ladder. But this may have been a stair step of these flat stones that's characteristic of this area. And because, excuse me, because he's going to call it the gate of heaven down here, a little bit later, verse 17, many have assumed that it's referring to a Babylonian ziggurat. And you say, well, how would Jacob know about Babylonian ziggurats? Well, I don't know. But I am saying that this stair step, this series of stones leading up to the heavens, was characteristic of Babylonian star worship. Maybe Jacob had heard about it some. Maybe the fact that he went to sleep thinking about these stones that were stacked up on one another. I'm not sure exactly, but I think it's more of a ladder of stones than it is a ladder like with rungs. The other thing surprising is that the angels of God were ascending and descending. Now, you think it'd be the other direction, it'd be coming down first. It was a dream whose basic meaning was to show Jacob that God was with him. Not only God personally, but God in the form of his assistants, the angels. So they are already with Jacob, and they've been with Jacob. Apparently, it's God's way of confirming that divine word back to Rebekah even before he was born. And so, and behold, the Lord stood above it. Now, the word above it, or beside it, or near it, it's interesting to me, the Lord stood. Here is God standing to speak to Jacob. That must have really encouraged Jacob, I think. God stood beside it, stood above it, and said, I am Yahweh, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. The land on which you live, or which you lie, I will give to you and to your descendants. I get so tickled. I was reading Rashi. The rabbi said that God in this moment compressed all the promised land into the size that Jacob could lay on. Baloney. It's the same deal. Wherever these patriarchs sojourned, God said, I'll give it to you. I'll give it to you. And so he made the same promise today. He's confirming personally what Isaac had told Jacob earlier, and that was, here you have the Abrahamic blessing. And here is the God of Abraham himself reaffirming that. I will give it to you and to your descendants. Now, that you think he was interested in that, in that he's about to go off and find himself a wife? Sure, he's thinking about that. Your descendants shall also be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread out to the west, the east, the north, and the south. If you see Bethel, kind of in the foothills of Ephraim, you see it's right in the middle of the promised land. And so here's an affirmation. He's going to have children, and they're going to possess this whole land. Another affirmation here. And in you and your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Now, this is very similar back to Genesis 26:4 that I talked about a couple of times before. In Genesis 26:4, it says, shall be blessed. And we talked about the fact that there two times we have this very special construction. Now, back in 26:6, it's in the Hithpael, which means shall bless themselves. But here in 28:14, it's in the Niphal, which means they shall be blessed. Now, we find the Niphal in chapter 12, verse 3, the original covenant to Abraham, in 18:18, in 28:24. We also find it twice in the New Testament, Acts 3:25, Galatians 3:8. Now, those New Testament passages are quoting the Septuagint. And in the Septuagint translation, done about 250 B.C., the translators don't make any distinction between the Hithphile and the Nephile. So, I'm not sure if the distinction is meant to be or not. But it's this wonderful universal promise that somehow through Jacob and his descendants, the whole earth is going to be blessed. Of course, we know that through the Messiah and his substitutionary death for all men. Let me continue then. Verse 15. And behold, I am with you. Oh, that's the promise he made with Isaac back in 26:3. That's the promise he made with Abraham. I am your shield. Oh, boy. Can you have a better promise than God is with you? Is there anything superior to the presence of God? None of his gifts compare with his presence. I am. And that's a form of that covenant name, Yahweh. I am with you. Boy, that's heavy. I think when I think of that, Jesus saying, and lo, I myself am with you to the end of the age. Matthew 28, the Great Commission. And I will keep you wherever you go. Now, some make a big deal here about Jacob thought that God was a national God or a local God. I think that's reading way too much in the Old Testament. Jacob was just glad that though God was back there with Isaac and Rebekah, he was also with Jacob. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. Wow. I will not leave you till I have done what I have promised you. You might want to write a parallel passage down, Deuteronomy 7:9. These same promises are going to be made to national Israel. Through Jesus, they're made to us individually again. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Yahweh is in this place, and I did not know it. It didn't look like a holy place. Now, a lot of commentators say it was a Canaanite shrine. Jacob says, this doesn't look like a shrine. This doesn't look like a place to meet God. It looked just like a regular place that I stopped, but God was here. I think it's significant that God appeared in a regular place, not a special place. The theology of that is good. I'm with you wherever you are. Not just in a sacred place. I'm with you wherever you are, Jacob. Wow. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. Well, exactly why he was afraid, I don't know. I think there's something about being in the presence of God that's awesome. Maybe he was afraid he profaned the place by sleeping there. Maybe he felt like he had seen God in that dream. This was the first time God appeared to Jacob. It was a pretty scary experience. Called it the house of God. Let's get the name Beth-El. Bethlehem, house of. Bethsaida, house of. Beth-El, house of. Now, depending whether it's a house of fish like Bethsaida, house of bread like Bethlehem, here it's house of God, Beth-El. Became a very important cultic center to the northern tribes, though later the site was perverted by some of the calf worship of Jeroboam I. Now, this gate of heaven has really been interesting. The rabbis struggle with this some. Now, they're assuming this is on Mount Moriah. And what they say is, see, the temple on Mount Moriah, which is not built, of course, yet, but that will be, is looking right across into the temple of heaven. And there's a ladder that connects them. Well, I think, first of all, that they're off geographically. And then I think they're off theologically. The gate here is not so much men approaching God, but it's what? This is the place that God comes to men. Verse 18. So Jacob rose up early in the morning and took the stone that he had put under his head. I get so tickled with folks when they say, how could Jacob raise this big a stone? We don't know how big a stone it is. Whatever stone he used for a pillow, he stood it up. Now, what's the symbol of this standing up? He's going to make it like a monument. We know that because he's going to set it up as a pillar,
and poured oil on the top of it. Now, what's the idea of pouring oil on it? Well, I'm not sure. You might want to see Genesis 31:13. Oil was some kind of symbol of it being a special monument. It's interesting to me that the root for the word oil or pour on is the same root as the root Messiah, which means the anointed one. So there is some implications here. You say, well, how many messianic implications do you see in this text? Well, the fact that Jesus in John 1:51 said, "I am Jacob's ladder," tells me there's quite a bit of messianic reference here, though I'm not sure Jacob understood it or even realized his actions were connected with the future Christ. It's obvious that through his seed, the whole world is going to be blessed. But the how and the wherefores, I don't think, are Jacob's. So they poured oil on top of it, set up this pillar. I think I'll say to you, later on in Judaism, this pillar had to be banned. Because what they begin to do is think, well, if this pillar is placed that stands for God, then this pillar must be a representation of God. And then they begin to carve the pillar. And these carved pillars became the sign of Baal worship, the male fertility god. And beside the altar of Baal was a carved wooden image of Asherah, the female deity. So it came later on in Deuteronomy and the rest of the Mosaic legislation. This is condemned and banned. But Jacob knows nothing of that. He's doing this in faith. So he set it up. And he called the name of the place Bethel. However, previously the name of the city had been Luz. Now, Luz means almond tree. And oddly, verse 19 is an editor going back and editing some of this. And I think that's obvious. We know from the history of this site that the Canaanites called it Luz and the Jews called it Bethel until the Jews finally took over the whole area and it became Bethel. And Jacob made a vow saying, a vow how? Well, he promised God. A vow means you promise something in God's name. Now, the structure is an if-then structure. And I must admit, when you first read it, Jacob comes across in a pretty shoddy fashion. For those who think that Jacob's been pretty shoddy from the first, it doesn't bother them that he's putting conditions on God. I'm not sure Jacob has been shoddy from the first. I grant you he did some really dumb, manipulative things, both with his brother and with his father. But it seems to me he's doing them for religious reasons. I think he's doing them because he realized God's going to use him. Now, I agree it's an if-then formula, but it seems to me everything God's promised him earlier, he's putting into some concrete terms. He's saying, you know, God, you promised me to be with me and help me and bless me. You know, I believe that. And if you're with me and clothe me and feed me and bring me back to my parents, then I'll know that you're my God. I don't think that's conditional. Maybe if those of you who know Greek, it's like a first-class conditional. He's assuming God's going to do that. And so he expresses this in a vow. If God will be with me and keep me on this journey that I take and will give me food to eat and garments to wear. He's not asking for the earth, the moon, the stars, and other things, is he? No, just the bare necessities. And I return to my father's house in safety and peace. Shalom. Then Yahweh will be my Elohim. Is that implying that until then he was not? I think not. That's reading way too much in here. Jacob is saying he knows the promise is with Isaac. Now God and his father both have said, I'm going to give it to you. And Jacob says, I'll know that when I come back. He's having to leave because of his brother's anger. He's leaving to fulfill the covenant promise about getting a believing wife. And he's asking God to be with him. And this stone, which I have set up as a pillar, will be God's house. And of all that thou givest me, I will surely give a tenth to thee. Sounds like Jacob is saying, I'm going to meet you back here, God. You've uniquely revealed yourself to me here. It's interesting to know that Jacob didn't stay here when he came back. Sacrifice, yes, but he didn't live around here close. I want to stop a minute and deal with it, and surely I'll give a tenth to thee. This seems right off the wall. There seems no precedent about this. There's been much discussion among scholars about the place of tithing in the Old Testament and the place of tithing in the New. If we go back to Genesis 14:20, Abraham paid a tithe to Melchizedek, which seems it's a culturally standard thing to do to the man of God. Here, Jacob makes the same statement that he's going to return to God that which belongs to God. Now, I personally believe a tithe, like worshiping on the Sabbath, like the firstborn belongs to God, is a Hebrew way of saying that all of life belongs to God. All of my money belongs to God. The first fruits, all the crop belongs to God. My first child, all my children belong to God. The Sabbath worship, all the days belong to God. Here, in a real sense, all of my provisions belong to God because God's the one who promised to provide them. Now, it's true we don't have much account of how Jacob paid this tithe or who he gave it to and all that. And there's a lot of things that aren't recorded in the Old Testament. But it seems to me that we must say that tithing came before the law of Moses. Before the temple, tithing was there. Therefore, I personally believe that tithing, in its sense in Malachi, is not a New Testament principle. And I would go to 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 for what I believe the New Testament guidelines for regular, joyful, sacrificial giving. But I think I would add these passages in Genesis that say, a good biblical example of a place to start that sacrificial giving would be the tithe. Now, I think that a tithe is just the place to start. I don't think it's a place to stop. But I do think it's significant because here it's pre-Mosaic. I don't think we can see the tithe as saying we have to give it to our local church and it's like storehouse tithing in Malachi. I don't believe that. I mean, you give a tithe to God. Sometimes we might want to split it between a local church and some other interests we have, like world hunger or helping an individual in Jesus' name. But I think this does set the precedent that a set part of our property, belongings, wealth, resources, we give to God as a symbol that all that we have belongs to God. And I think 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 backs that up. Well, this is the end of this chapter, and we find Jacob on his way about to meet Laban. If you think Jacob is a trickster, wait till you get a hold of Laban. Now, this guy is a manipulator, and we'll meet him in the next few lessons. I've enjoyed being with you. God bless you. Have a good day.